Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Batte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, October 20th, and here are some of the stories we are covering, remembering the late Colin Powell for peace in Sudan.
The thing that Colin Powell will be most remembered for is the testimony that he gave to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in which he called the violence in Darfur genocide. You know, that was the first time that that word had been used in that conflict.
Ugandan writers ignore risks for provoking President Museveni. Liberian refugees in Ghana plead for full integration into Ghanaian society. The UN says 17 million Kenyan children missed more than 6 months of schooling. And the Rwandan Defense Force says its troops unintentionally crossed into DRC this week.
Our security forces pursued a smuggler who crossed the Rwanda-DRC border. We are carrying unidentified packages, and we believe that they are also armed.
And Greenpeace welcomes DRC president's decision to suspend dubious concessions in the country. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. As the world continues to pay tribute to the late former U.S. Secretary of State General Colin Powell, an expert on Sudan says the late Powell, who died Monday this week from COVID complications, will be remembered in Sudan and South Sudan, as well as other African countries, for peacemaking and sounding the alarm to act against war abuses. Cameron Hudson, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Africa Center, is also former chief of staff of the Office of the U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan at the State Department, and former director of Africa at the White House. He tells VOA's Nabil Biagio that Powell will be remembered for being the first U.S. official to declare genocide in Darfur, as well as involvement in the Comprehensive Peace Agreement that ended Africa's longest-running war and paved the way for South Sudan's independence.
With respect to the Sudan, the thing that Colin Powell will be most remembered for is the testimony that he gave to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in which he called the violence in Darfur genocide. You know, that was the first time that that word had been used in that conflict. And it really became a rallying cry around the world and certainly within U.S. activist communities. And you saw the United States get, you know, even deeper involved in the conflict there. So it was really his decision to make, and he made it in the affirmative. And I think that that did a lot to blunt some of the criticism that the Bush administration had been taking at that time over, you know, the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, and was a very much of a principled stand, I think.
Yes, and of course he did that before the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee back in September 2004. What impact do you think that had in terms of the humanitarian response in Darfur, but also in terms of addressing the atrocities that were being committed under the government of Omar al-Bashir?
Well, I think that, you know, in retrospect, it was an effort, I think, to really shine a light on the conflict there and to try to rally international support for a more organized and sustained response to the violence there. And so, you know, ultimately, I don't think it particularly succeeded because you saw the violence continue to get worse and worse for several years. And even today, the situation in Darfur is not fully resolved. And so, you know, it was an effort, certainly, I think, by the administration and by Colin Powell in particular, to acknowledge the nature of the crime being committed. But also, I think it was a recognition of the fact that even in the face of such abhorrent crimes, the United States has only limited leverage in bringing them to an end. And we're seeing that in places like Tigray today, where you have horrific human rights violations bordering on genocide and an inability to fundamentally shape the outcome in that conflict.
Powell was, of course, the 65th United States Secretary of State from 2001 to 2005. And that was an interesting time in Sudan for another reason. Big events were happening, mainly the lead up to the 2005 Comprehensive Peace Agreement, which ended Sudan's longest civil war, and Africa's longest civil war, actually. What role did he play in that process and in those events in terms of his involvement?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think that he was there to oversee the appointment of the very first special envoy to Sudan, Senator John Danforth, who, you know, began the effort of getting the United States much more deeply and personally involved in the politics of Sudan. Senator Danforth made a number of trips to Sudan and recommended to Secretary Powell that the United States had a positive role to play in trying to bring peace to Sudan. And so from those recommendations, you saw the creation of a Sudan office in the State Department under Colin Powell. You saw his personal involvement in the negotiations, culminating in the 2005 signing of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement in Nairobi, which Colin Powell traveled to and bore witness to as a guarantor of that. And so I think that, you know, for as much as certainly that period of the Bush administration is known for sort of war making in the world, I think that Colin Powell reflects that there was a very, very strong peacemaking element within certainly his State Department at the time. And I think he took a great deal of pride in the efforts of the administration to try to bring about a peace to Sudan's longest running civil war.
That was Cameron Hudson, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Africa Center. He spoke with VOA's Nabil Biagio. The Rwanda Defense Force, the RDF, says its troops unintentionally entered the Democratic Republic of Congo on Monday this week. The Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Rwanda, the FDLR, a Rwanda Hutu rebel group, is based in the DRC. RDF spokesperson Colonel Ronald Rivanga says the troops were chasing smugglers who crossed the border into Rwanda carrying unidentified packages and were also believed to have been armed.
Yesterday, our security forces pursued a smuggler who crossed the Rwanda-DRC border at a place called Bujeshi sector in Rubavu district. And so the law enforcement officers unintentionally crossed a few meters into DRC while pursuing the smugglers who were carrying unidentified packages. And we believe that they were also armed. They pursued them and entered the DRC accidentally.
You say unintentionally crossed into DRC. So are you suggesting that you did not notify the government of the DRC?
We couldn't have because it was unintentional. So in the process, the DRC saw our forces and there was a few minutes of engagement, but nothing really much transpired. We eventually settled everything and we went back home.
Does Rwanda believe the DRC is not doing enough to contain these anti-Rwanda militias like the FDLR?
They have been doing a lot lately trying to deal with the problem. I think even the forces are located there. This is clearly a sign that they are doing a lot to ensure that they deny the FDLR from operating in the forests of Congo. The fact that they are there physically is a good sign that they're doing something.
Colonel, what can you tell us about Burundi handing over to Rwanda 11 anti-Rwanda FLN fighters?
Yeah, it happened today, this afternoon, where the heads of intelligence of both Rwanda and Burundi, in the presence of United Nations and AU officials and the joint verification mechanism, they handed over 11 FLN fighters. And this is a very good bilateral gesture. And it shows that there are good relations between both countries. We have also done in the past provided fighters to them, people who crossed into Rwanda. So this is one of the gestures of good cooperation between both countries.
Why do you suppose, Colonel, that all these anti-Rwanda militias are operating from your neighbors? What's happening in Rwanda?
It's normal for operatives to choose to operate in neighboring countries. It's been going on for a long time. But the fact that the governments today are willing to hand over elements that are tested is a very good sign.
Thank you, Colonel.
Thank you so much, James.
Colonel Ronald Rivanga is the spokesperson for the Rwanda Defense Force. You are speaking with us from the capital, Kigali. The Ugandan government is known for cracking down on writers who express strong dissent to President Yoweri Museveni, who has ruled the country for 35 years. Despite the risks, two writers recently composed deliberately provocative pieces criticizing the president. Halima Atumani reports from Kampala.
Early this month, Ashava Anna wrote an erotic poem on Facebook to Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni titled, I Want to Be Museveni's Side Chick. The poem reads in part, I want to be Museveni's side chick so that when, after reading a poem for him, I tell him that censorship, arrest, torture, and imprisonment of writers is inhuman, cowardly an act, and violation of rights. Speaking to VOA, Ashava says that she decided to write the poem after a long observation and listening to several of Museveni's addresses. She says it was clear the government's response to the concerns of citizens was relaxed.
Someone needs to tell this person that we are tired. First of all, the education crisis, schools are closed, teachers are not working. I said if he asks me the kind of car he wants, I'll ask him to give me an ambulance and I donate it to hospitals.
The Ugandan government has previously come down hard on writers who pen opinions on how the current regime is handling citizens' concerns. This has included arrests, imprisonment, and torture, among others. 23-year-old Ashava did not face any of these, but she too caught the eye of the authorities and was summoned by the deputy director of the Internal Security Organization.
He called and said, I want to have a chat with you. I was scared. And he said, no, we just want to have a chat. So they asked me this one important question. So what do you want? And I gave them the answer that as a writer, I had gotten what I wanted. The fact that the message had reached the powers that be.
While officiating at the World Teachers Day, celebrated on October 12th, Museveni, when asked by teachers to increase pay for all teachers, insisted only science teachers' pay should be increased and not for those teaching arts.
Don't mix up salary with authority, saying that if the administrators get less pay than the scientists, that it will spoil administration. I am the president of Uganda. If you want to check my power, you try it.
Danson Kahiana, a senior lecturer at Makerere University, said he was angered by Museveni's comments and took to Facebook to express his disappointment. In a post titled, Someone Tell the Life President to Shut Up, he says, someone tell the Life President that it is okay to have the parliament and the judiciary and the army and the police safely in his armpit, but there is a species of people, the art scholars, who know how smelly every armpit gets.
My Facebook post was a form of challenge to him to say, well, I think if you don't have something to say about the arts and how important they are to the country, maybe you should just shut up and listen to people educate you about this. Being a president doesn't mean that you know everything.
In a text message to VOA, government spokesperson Nofono Pondo says these writers are seeking to make names and hopefully gain the spotlight. He says Museveni does not need to be insulted to be heard. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, October 20th. At least 1.1 million children in Kenya dropped out of school due to poverty, hunger, female genital mutilation, and early marriages. The United Nations International Children's Emergency Fund, UNICEF, says school closures due to COVID-19 interrupted learning for over 17 million children who missed more than 6 months of formal education. Maureen Ojiambo reports from Milwaukee, USA.
Kenya has made gains in reaching remote areas and disadvantaged communities at primary and pre-primary level. In pastoral communities, where high dropout rates were recorded, indicates that children in the region did not see any value in schooling. Long distances to school also affected them, and high rate of child marriage. They also faced increased risks of violence, child labor, and mental health. The chief executive officer, National Council for Nomadic Education in Kenya, Haran Yusuf, said that the Kenyan government has launched a new drive to get more than 250,000 children back to school.
This three-year program targets 250,000 out-of-school children, 50% girls, 50% boys, and 5% children with disability. The goal is to enroll and retain them all the way through their learning journey to transition into positive, well-equipped humans for the world of work. The counties targeted include Garissa, Wajir, Turkana, Marsabit, Samburu, Isiolo, was performed Tana River, Mandera, Nairobi, Kilifi, Kuala, Kajiado, Baringo, and Bungoma.
The Back to School initiative is targeting children aged 6 to 13 years in 16 counties. The chief education at the UNESCO East Africa, Saido Jalo, said that UNICEF has embarked on bringing equity in education across Kenya.
We would like to call the Minister of Education, with the support of partners, to fast-track the efforts of inclusion and equity through addressing through policy all forms and all forms of exclusion and discrimination and disparities, inequality and inequalities in and through education. Establishment of policy frameworks, guidelines, etc. on out-of-school will be very useful in moving forward and addressing the issue of out-of-school. Interventions to engage stakeholders in advocacy campaigns to enhance enrollment of disadvantaged children, most vulnerable, and those living with disability.
The pupil-to-teacher ratio remains very high in some counties. For example, in Turkana County, teacher-student ratio is 1 to 77. George Baude, Senior Regional Advisor, Africa Regional Field Network, said that Kenya has children of school-going age who are completely out of school and others in school but facing challenges.
We do have two categories. One of them is those who are not in school, and those who are in school but are facing a risk of dropping out before the end of the school year, right? So for a given year, we have these two situations. But among those who are not in school, we also have some subcategories there. Some have never attended school. Some will have the opportunity to go later on. And we have also those who were there already in school but dropped out for several reasons.
Over 17 million children in Kenya are recovering from up to 9 months of lost learning due to COVID-19. Before the COVID-19 pandemic, primary school enrollment in Kenya was at 99%, but at secondary level, it was only at 71%. However, issues such as poor quality teaching and large class sizes still affect the quality of children's learning. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Milwaukee, USA.
Thousands of Liberian refugees who have been living in Ghana since 1990 at the Buduburam refugee camp are appealing to the Ghanaian government and the UNHCR to make good on their promises to fully integrate them by giving them work permits. Dennis Guyan, president of the Buduburam camp, says the refugees also want the government to relocate them now that the government says it wants to demolish the camp. The head of the Ghana Refugee Board, which is part of the Ghanaian Ministry of Interior, agreed to speak with VOA, but did not follow through. Guyan says the refugees are not trying to claim Buduburam. They simply want the government to fulfill its promises.
Since we came to Ghana in 1990 as a result of the war in Liberia, we were saying to Buduburam, the government of this country, Ghana, 2003, we were given a UN ID card of refugees in this country. From 2003 to 2012, we said there was a sensation for Liberian refugee status. So the sensation was invoked. Ghanaian refugee board came to Buduburam and said there is two options for Liberian to decide, either you go home or you be integrated in Ghana. And before that process, Ghana refugee board campaigned heavily among Liberians that if you are integrated in Ghana, you will have a better life to live. In fact, you will be removed from Buduburam to a new location where they're going to build houses for us to be. They're going to give you Ghana card. They're going to make your kids to go to school. All of the promises they made convinced Liberians to be integrated. Now, those who took the integration, they promised to give a Liberian passport. They're going to give a resident permit, a work permit to work in Ghana. We've been here until 2018, and we were still asking, are we still going to live with Buduburam for the rest of our life? They don't respond to us. Until almost recent, when the district assembly decides to demolish the camp, they send a notice all over that we should leave Buduburam on the 30th of September. And we said, how? Because we were promised that we were going to be relocated on Buduburam.
Mr. Guyan, you said you received notices to leave the camp. Did you find out exactly who posted these notices?
Yeah, we found out from the district assembly. You know, Buduburam camp was in a district called Goma East. And the notice was signed by the chief executive of the Goma East district assembly.
You say you were given resident status. Have you been able to work with that status?
No, even within the residence that they give us, look in the middle of the residence, there's no other occupation or business for reward is permitted. That's the restriction in the residence. It means that we can't work in Ghana.
Have you made any representation with the UN Refugee Agency and with the Ghanaian government?
We have written the Minister of Interior, who is the head of the Ghana Refugee Board. We have written even the Speaker of the Parliament of Ghana on this situation. We wrote UNHCR and even the Ghana Refugee Board. Up to now, there is no reply for them. Us.
As you rightly said, you and the others came to Ghana in the 1990s because of the civil war. I've spoken with many of you there soon after the war, and the question I asked was, why don't you just return to Liberia?
Why we don't go to Liberia? Those who opted for local individual Ghana felt that Liberia was not safe for them. And it's on an individual cases. There are other who decided to go back home, and they go back home.
So what's next now for you? What do you plan to do?
We are asking the government of Ghana to implement the education package because you promised us. Give us the housing. We are not fighting for the land that is district one is demolished, us is on. But we are saying that what you said to us before, even the process, give us the housing and we'll move there and change the resident permit in our passport. Give us work permit. And in fact, you promised us to give us Ghana card. Even as we speak now, if you don't have the Ghana card, you can use the same card to communicate in Ghana. And these are some of the obstacles. And we are asking them to remove all of the obstacles. Give up the houses for us to move, change our resident permit in our book, and give up the Ghana card that will be able to move freely in Ghana.
I'm sure many of you have children and perhaps even grandchildren. How have you been living if you're not allowed to work?
Some are planting here in Manhattan Market or Tema Abubushi in Accra there for survival. And few are doing, from those businesses they are doing, they go and plant here, come back and open a business to really sell cool water, sell dry goods, garbage, and half of them surviving here.
Mr. Guyon, it's so nice to talk with you.
Thank you so much. Nice talking to you.
Dennis Guyon is president of the Budu Buram Refugee Camp, which is housing thousands of Liberian refugees in Ghana. You're speaking with us from Accra. Democratic Republic of Congo President Felix Tshisekedi announced last Friday that the country would suspend what he calls dubious logging concessions in the country, including six that were granted in September 2020. Greenpeace Africa, while welcoming the decision, says the government must also maintain the moratorium on new industrial logging concessions. Patient Muamba, a forest campaigner in Kinshasa, spoke to Ricky Stryak about the details.
This started last year, on September last year, where the former environmental minister granted six concessions to a company, and then we found that it was illegal, and then we asked for the minister to cancel that contract. So on Friday, President Tshisekedi asked the environmental minister suspend all that concession, and then he asked also to have an audit on a forest sector. We are here now to say that, yeah, it's a good thing that the president understood what Greenpeace was asking, but we are aiming that it will not be only the suspension of that concession, but we need the cancellation of this concession.
Does this have an impact on the environment minister's announcement in July that there would be a lift on a ban of any new industrial logging concessions?
Yes, DRC have the second largest forest, rainforest after the Amazonas. So we are asking for the minister to suspend the decision. So the environmental minister proposed to the Conseil of Ministers to leave the moratorium. So the moratorium was in place since 2002, and it was to stop all allocation, all new allocation in the forest sector. We are asking to stop that kind of allocating new concession, because this is the way of destroying the forest and contribute to the climate crisis that all the world are asking for, to protect the climate.
That was Patient Muamba, a forest campaigner. You are speaking to Ricky Stryer from Kinshasa. And that's it for this Wednesday, October 20th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you will have a very good day.